The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop, looking out over London.
Good night, and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
All right, welcome to a Thursday, everyone. I am Nicole Sandler at NicoleSandler.com and on the Progressive Voices Network. And on Thursdays, we usually hang out with Howie Klein. We talk politics. Howie's out on vacation. He will return next week. But we have a busy show for you today. In the second half of the program, we're going to talk about education, what's happening with the strikes that are going on across the nation. But to start things off, I want to welcome an old friend back to the program. Cliff Schechter is the co-host of the Unprecedented podcast and a contributor to the Daily Beast. And imagine my surprise as I'm reading the New York Times on Tuesday and I see an op-ed from Cliff Schechter about something that I've been railing about for a while now. It's called "With Sinclair, We Have Trump TV. America Doesn't Need More." There's a place in my heart for someone who writes this. Hey, Cliff Schechter.
Hey, Nicole, how are you?
I'm doing okay. And you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on.
Well, if you are satisfied with your message, press 1 to listen to your message. Press 2 to erase and re-record. Press 3 to continue recording where you left off. Press 4.
I think it's my fault. I think I called you.
Are you still there?
I'm going to call you back. This is live radio. All right,
press,
let me call you right back.
Erase and re-record.
Okay.
Press 3 to continue recording where you left off.
I hung up on
press
Cliff,
4.
And I still have this message thing going on. That's weird.
Are you still there?
No.
If you're satisfied with your message.
All right, this is live radio at its best, huh?
To erase and re-record.
All right, how do I hang
press
up on
3
this?
To continue recording where you left off, press 4.
How do I hang up? To hang up, press...
You're having trouble. Your message has been sent. Goodbye.
Okay, goodbye. Yay. All right, now we can call Cliff Schechter back, right? Let's call him back now. Don't you love live radio, especially without a producer? This is my lot in life. All right.
Hello.
Hi, so much better.
Oh, my God, I can hear you clearly. Hopefully you can hear me clearly.
Yes.
If that's preferable.
Much better. And we won't have the phone lady call, telling me to leave you a message. Anyway, so Cliff Schechter, so there I am reading the New York Times, and I see your op-ed about Sinclair Broadcasting, and I didn't know that you had ever worked for them.
Yeah, not something I brag about often, it was sort of back when I was doing a lot of the TV debates that I used to do much more often,
mm-hmm.
which were, MSNBC, and I was crazy enough to wake up early and go on Fox and Friends. God,
oh, boy.
I don't think you could offer me almost anything in the world to do that these days. There were one or two clips I did that got shared around by a decent number of people, one of the senior executives at Sinclair reached out and asked me to come on as a guest, which I did, to debate one of their conservatives. And after that, they were looking for somebody on the left. And remember, this is 2004. I should have started with that.
Right.
And so I didn't know much about what Sinclair was. And so I went there and, I noticed that, of course, like I used to notice at Fox, that the host, as well as the other pundit who was billed as a conservative pundit, were both arguing with me. So I got pretty quickly picked up on the fact that they were conservative, but I learned more and more as I was there. And it wasn't like I was an in-house you know, like I didn't work for them as in that was my 9-to-5 job being there, mm-hmm. but I was a paid political analyst to go on the air and debate issues. And, you know, it's in hindsight now, there are a lot of things and they all added up that eventually when I left, I realized what, you know, what I'd been there for. Remember, this is 2004. So here's the John Kerry Swift boat documentary. I put that in quotes.
Yes.
Sinclair promoted that. I became aware while I was there. The New York Times piece had a lot of these things. It couldn't keep all these because they have a length limit for their op-eds, and I probably could have gone on for 2,000 words. But there was an obsession there. I don't know if you remember back then, there was a gubernatorial race in 2002. They're based in Baltimore, and there's a 2002 gubernatorial race between the guy who eventually won, Bob Ehrlich, the Republican from Maryland, and Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, who lost. And I found that they had been obsessed. I was there in 2004. In 2002, they had basically spent all these resources and all this time on trying to prove that when she'd fallen off of a horse she was riding, that she'd gotten brain damage.
Oh,
sound like familiar for the stuff they tried to do with Hillary eventually?
Yes.
I mean, interesting, it's always women candidates they do it to, too. So, you know, I started noticing those kinds of things. I was debating Armstrong Williams, who was the guy who came out later, was being paid $250,000 to the table by the Bush administration to say nice things about Leave No Child Behind, even while he was, you know, objectively, quote-unquote, arguing in favor of it, supposedly, on Sinclair with me. I mean, there was all sorts of stuff like that. So I picked up on it. I knew they were right-wing. I knew that after that, you know, I probably wasn't going to come back and never do anything again unless, you know, there was some sort of defined terms of engagement with them. But it was, I mean, you know, it was a hell of an experience to learn about, you know, I feel like it taught me a lot about right-wing media because I was in the belly of the beast. I overheard plenty of conversations. I met the owners, the Smith brothers, who are all right-wing lunatics there, and kind of got an idea for the kind of paranoia and resentment, and we can keep naming those various adjectives to describe what is the modern right.
Right. Back in 2004, though, it was a small group of TV stations. Back then, I don't know what they were, but I'm sure the ownership rules were vastly different than they are now. I know when I first got into radio back in the olden days, there were really strict rules. Like one company could own one AM station, one FM station, and one television station in a market. And I think there was a cap of like 7 of each. There were really tough.
That's right.
This was, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, I'm dating myself. And, you know, Reagan had a lot to do with doing away with the Fairness Doctrine and a lot of the rules governing broadcast ownership. Back in 2004, the rules were still stricter than they are now. So Sinclair was just another group that owned a bunch of TV stations, but they weren't the behemoth they are now. And the thing is, they're a behemoth that at this point owns 193 stations, with 42 more sitting there dangling out there as the FCC decides whether or not to approve the sale of Tribune Broadcasting. This is a really dangerous precedent. Sinclair is now the largest owner of individual television stations.
That's right. And there's a few other things going on. I mean, I try to point to people and say, look, I mean, the airwaves, we've all complained about the media so much,
mm-hmm.
And with good cause. Mainstream media, which is pressured by right-wing media, so they try to show this fake balance. I mean, you may have seen just right before your show that Kevin Williamson was now let go from The Atlantic before he ever started, because here they hired this guy so that they could seem like they're balanced, who'd argued for women who'd had abortions to be hung.
Right.
I mean, the finding reasonable intellectual voices on the right these days is no easy task. I'm not saying they don't exist, center-right, legitimate voices who I disagree with, but I think are honest in how they come to their opinions, and I can debate them, and you can, and whatever. But there's so many of them are part of this demagogic entertainment complex. And all of that began, as you're saying, you know, with what started happening largely in the 1980s. And, I mean, so it's ironic, because, of course, the book that we all think of is 1984,
mm-hmm.
which seemed like Orwell was just about right on. And if you think about when he wrote that book, and if you know the movie even begins, I mean, in big parts, if you ever see the movie, you read the book, which is better, you get the sense of how the whole thing with Big Brother and everything, they controlled the media, because we understood when he was writing that book in 1949, we'd seen what had happened in Hitler's Germany and Mussolini's Italy and what was going on in Stalin's Russia. And we understood that this was one of the key elements of gaining control over any populist in an authoritarian government, was control of the media. And it's almost like when, you know, people who had been mature adults during that period of time, or even those who were growing up then, started dying off, that was when the right was able to make a renewed assault on our media. And you bring up Reagan, they got rid of the Fairness Doctrine in 1987. It's no coincidence that in the couple years after that, you see Rush Limbaugh and Bob Grant and all these crazy right-wing voices come out, because the Fairness Doctrine didn't only say that there had to be balance, you know, like legitimate voices on both sides of a debate, but it also said, it had a very important phrase on there, which was public good. Media had to exist for the public good. If they were going to give you a license, be it a radio license or a TV broadcast license, like a network license, you had to provide a public good.
Yes.
And that was the expectation. That was the culture. You did it.
You had to also,
with the Fairness Doctrine,
you also had to serve, you had to serve your community. Each station, the local aspect of a broadcast station, whether radio or TV, was licensed to the community that it was supposed to serve. And you had to prove each year, each time your license came up for renewal, how you were serving the community. You had to go out into the community and do what was called ascertainment and find out the top 10 issues facing your community and show how you're addressing them with your public service programming. All that went away.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. So, I mean, we understood the media is an incredibly powerful and can be an incredibly positive tool to inform people and to get people to be active in their communities and to, you know, serve the public good. We got all this, but we also saw, again, going back to when Orwell wrote his book, in the wake of World War II, with these various authoritarian governments that had risen, That especially with modern media at that point, which was beginning, you know, radio was obviously had been used by FDR and the fireside chats, and in a negative way by Father Coughlin, who, you know, used anti-Semitism to stir people up during the Great Depression against Jews and bankers and this and that. And we understood that. And we even were seeing, of course, by the late 40s, we're starting to see TV as something of the future that could be the same kind of a medium, and yet we forget all that by 1987, and even, you know, and again, it wasn't, you know, Republicans were the ones in the right wing were pushing for this, because they realized if we're going to have a fair debate on issues, then there has to be a debate. You know what I mean? Like, there is no debate on global warming. There is no debate on whether increasing access to birth control increases or decreases abortion. There is no debate over, you know, evolution. There is no debate over whether more guns leads to more shootings or fewer shootings. There's fake BS made up by one side that has absolutely zero scientific evidence to back up what they say, but there's no legitimate debate over these things. And so the right realized that they could never sort of get to where they wanted to get to if that rule that called for balance and called for a public good was in place. And so they eliminated it. But those of us on the left, and even those, you know, I worked for Bill Clinton's reelection in 1996. That Telecommunications Act that he signed was probably one of the most harmful pieces of legislation signed, you know, in the past 30 years. I can say that because I can be willing to be critical of my own. That was a huge oversight and incredible, you know, whatever the reasons behind that were, they were wrong and bad. And what we've allowed to happen with our media has been so injurious to democracy. And what's the result? Well, look at the White House if you want to know what the result is.
Right. And now, you know, it's bad enough that, you know, Fox TV is state television. I'm trying to remember what Chris Hayes calls it, but the official state TV channel or something like that. But now he's got it with Sinclair as well. We just heard a story the other day that Jared Kushner had actually made some kind of pact with them for straight coverage, for whatever that means. We know what that means.
Non-gay coverage, probably on the right. I'm kidding. But you're exactly right. They wanted unfiltered Trump, as in, again, if there is an objective, if we have an objective truth would be that Trump's a raving lunatic. And all it takes is most of us to watch that on TV and know that that's true, that this is not the way normal people behave when they speak, when more people, when they get up in front of the Boy Scouts, don't start ripping on the person they well, I'll put beat quotes, depending on how you define it. If you define it by our electoral college, which we do, the person he beat in the election. Like, normal people don't behave like that. You know, they don't get up and call a group of people rapists, you know, the whole entire race of people. I mean,
right.
Or nationality. I mean, so you know, they don't do, so Trump, you know, Sinclair and Trump, what they can do with their quote unquote straight coverage is no one criticizes Trump for being a lunatic and they act like it's normal and they cover him in all these local stations. And the danger of that, of course, which is the danger of these people reading these hostage statements, which is how the issue came up again. All these news anchors on those 193 stations are talking about reading these ridiculous statements. The danger is that we all tend to be more trusting of our local news media personalities. We see them maybe, especially in places that aren't New York City and Los Angeles and Chicago. Mm-hmm. I live in Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. I know some of the local news personalities. I'll see them out at restaurants or a coffee shop or whatever. You know who they are. They're in your local community. You trust them. So if they're given these ridiculous talking points to read, you know, you may be more likely to believe it. You probably will be.
And now we're reading about how difficult, you know, there's a lot of criticism on them. Well, why don't they walk away? First of all, it's not that easy to find a job these days. Hello. As many of us can attest.
Right.
Especially in broadcast when there's so much consolidation. But now we find that some of these local news personalities have provisions written into their contracts with Sinclair that if they're to quit, they have to pay back all the costs of marketing, like if they put up billboards or things like that. I mean, it would cost the employee a fortune to quit. So they, I mean, you call them hostage tapes. They really are in some cases where these people have no choice. They have to do what they're told.
No, you're right. I mean, and you slide into that area, and I think some of us can forget that too, where people are trying to raise families, they have kids, they need to make a living, and, you know, and that's, we need to keep that in mind. On the other side of things, we do have to all ask ourselves questions, which is, when do we say that we can't do this anymore? When do we say that, you know, I need to support my kids economically, but I also need to ensure that they live in a democracy, and I don't want to be a part and parcel to leading us to a place where we're not that if we still are. and you know, that's the thing is, and I'm not blaming these news personalities. A couple have already quit. A producer mm-hmm. in Nebraska for the station said that was the final straw and stood up and quit. I think a news personality in one other market, I can't think where, I think that just happened maybe today or yesterday. And then a number of others, like in Madison, Wisconsin,
right.
I think they just said, we're not going to do it.
That's right.
You know, we're not reading it, and too bad, and, you know, come get us if you want to. So I want to be clear. I respect the hell out of that, and at the same time, I do understand, you know, the pressures on both sides. I mean, we all fight for our democracy. We wouldn't be here having this conversation, you and I and people listening, if we didn't. At the same time, we need to feed our families, and so it's kind of a, you know, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't, but I do have to say I'd encourage, obviously, anybody who is not going to sort of put themselves out in the street by leaving a job like that, is if there are other opportunities, if there is anything else you can do comparable to do something else, because if you went to news for the reason you probably went into it, that's not it.
Of course not. Right. But I believe there are a number of people who are just sort of waiting out till the end of their contract when they could leave. It'll be bad enough that they'll be unemployed, but at least it won't cost them money to lose
well, sure.
the job.
I totally understand that. And I guess the big question there, I've seen, you know, and this is another sort of nasty aspect that I've run into, and maybe you have in our democracy, which is the outsized power when we allow these billionaires to walk among us, is that they can come after you and you can have done nothing wrong. But if they can get you into a courtroom so you have to spend money on a lawyer, they realize mm-hmm. they can bleed you dry and it's
right.
not going to bother them one bit. That's what Donald Trump made a living of doing with subcontractors and people he hired, which he'd say, I'm going to pay you half of what I told you I was going to pay you. And if you argue with me, we'll go to court over it. And by the time you're done, you'll have lost all of your money anyhow. And that's, you know, that's these contracts. So I've seen some people say these contracts are not enforceable, that they're BS. And they're not, but the problem is that, you know, they're
you
not
gotta fight them.
If you get sued.
Right.
And you're not a lawyer and you need to show up, or you don't have a close family member who's a good lawyer and you need to pay somebody and show up with somebody that, you know, so I do understand that. It's not, there are no easy answers here. Whenever anybody tries to sell you easy answers and what's going on right now, don't trust them. There aren't. You know, we're in a dangerous times and everybody needs to stand up and do what they can, but there's often more than one thing going on there. Let's put it that way.
Most definitely. Well, Cliff Schechter, in your piece for the New York Times, which I'll link on my blog today, at NicoleSandler.com, of course. Well, thank you for writing it. You talk about maybe it's time to bring back the fairness doctrine. That would be wonderful. but you say certainly it's time to force the FCC to follow the law and fulfill its mandate under our laws to promote diversity of access to the public airwaves. Meanwhile, I don't know what the time frame is on it, but this FCC, it looks like it's getting ready to approve the sale of Tribune Broadcasting to Sinclair, which will add another, 42 stations onto that 193? Yep.
They'll reach 72% of American households at that point, which is outrageous. And, you know, and that's the thing, and that's why I appreciate your having me on and others who have and others who shared it. Because, you know, we do need that. I mean, I would argue that we do need to bring the fairness doctrine back, although the only reason why I said maybe is because I would maybe like it in a slightly different form, a more stringent form. I wouldn't want the fairness doctrine to turn into the kind of fake balance we have today, where it would say, oh, you need balance. So now on issues where there really is no debate scientifically, we're going to allow some right-winger to come on and say global warming doesn't exist because he saw snow outside.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I want an updated version of it that I think reflects the environment we're in. Certainly the mandate is there already for the FCC. They are supposed to be supporting diversity of ownership, coverage of local news. They're not. They're ignoring their mandate under the law. And that's why I would go a step further, and I would say we need to codify this in law. It's much like other things that we just always assumed in the past before the rise of the modern right would be protected, or at least we wouldn't go so far afield of where we've gone, whether it's the ridiculousness of super PACs and money in politics to the more recent voter purges. We just always assumed that, you know, we'd keep updating the Voting Rights Act. Well, now we should put a law in place that doesn't need to be updated every year or every couple of years. It just is. And it's the same thing with us. There needs to be a law mandating and putting a cap back on ownership levels, both in the country, within a market and cross market. And we have to also remember that there used to be limits. You can only own one kind of media. There were sort of legacy exceptions to this, but one kind of media in a market. So you didn't control, you know, TV, radio, print. I mean, think about something like Fox News in the New York market. They have the New York Post. Yeah. They have the Wall Street Journal. They have Fox News. You know, they've got their radio properties. They've got their online properties, which is the whole new dimension here. I mean, think of how much influence they have. You know, one could argue Chris Christie maybe never would have been elected governor of New Jersey, which is a big New York media market state, and had the image that he had if it weren't for all the Fox properties or all the, what you call, News Corp properties going to bat for him the way they
right.
did. You know?
Right.
And this is incredibly important to our democracy.
And now we have, the FCC. I don't know if it's the FCC or if it's who has. I think it is the FCC. They may be holding up the AT&T merger with Time Warner because of a Trump desire, because he doesn't like CNN,
yep.
Right? So for his personal...
Oh, yeah. There's that one, and there's how he's going after Amazon. Believe me, you know, I'm all for the fact we get back to what we used to do and break up monopolies. Monopolies are terrible for democracy.
Yeah.
They're terrible for competitive markets. And if you believe in regulated capitalism, they destroy it. So there are many reasons that I don't think Amazon should have the monopoly it has. And yet at the same time, the reasons that Trump is going after them are ridiculous. He doesn't like the Washington Post reports on him. And of course, Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post.
That's
so
right.
That's a reason to go after him, not because of actual legitimate concerns. And that's what, as you know, that's what autocrats do. They don't just sort of, you know, have rampant free capitalism with no safety net. They pick winners, you know, that's part of it. I mean, they do cut safety nets, but they also pick winners and losers. They decide if you're an oligarch who's friendly to Vladimir Putin, guess what? You get to keep your stuff. If you're
that's
somebody
right.
who challenges him or runs against him, you know, you have to either leave the country like somebody like Garry Kasparov, or you end up going to prison like Kartakovsky or some of the others that have taken him on there. And that's what, you know, we haven't gotten to that level and hopefully never will here. But that's the kind of thing we're seeing right now.
Right.
And Bezos criticizes me, I'm going to go after him.
And the only way to turn it around, it kind of goes without saying, but we have to say it, is through the ballot box. Because as long as Trump is in power, as long as the Republicans control both houses of Congress and the executive branch, we're, plain and simple, we're fucked. Sinclair will get those Tribune stations, and they may just give in to Donald Trump's whims and do his personal vendettas for him. But he likes Sinclair, so they're going to get what they want because they're doing his bidding. So it's the ballot box. Well, this is our chance.
That's it, folks, and that's why I always say, you know, and I know this isn't always popular in some parts of the left, but I keep saying we need to all unite and take this on. We can have our disagreements. We can disagree how strong the very strong safety net I hope we all agree on. We can, you know, disagree whether we believe in a social democracy or socialism or liberalism or whatever it might be. But we all need to unite because this is existential. I mean, the things that happen like this don't always lead to authoritarian governments with their democracies that have gone to places like this and come back, and plenty of them. But they can. And every time you look at a place that was once a democracy that ended up in authoritarianism, this is how it starts. It starts by picking winners and losers, the people that like you, the ones whose businesses get the government contracts and are okay, the other guys go to prison. You take over the airwaves and have them support mm-hmm. you. You do what you can. I mean, we just saw in Wisconsin on Tuesday, you know, that huge vote for the Supreme Court where the liberal justice or, you know, progressive, whatever you want to call it, beat the right wing Scott Walker supporting, Trump supporting, NRA supporting loon by double digits. And that's the first time that's happened in a long period of time. We have the energy on our side. We have the passion. We just got to, you know, we got to get out there and vote.
There you go. Cliff Schechter, again, his op-ed was in Tuesday's New York Times. It was called "With Sinclair, We Have Trump TV. America Doesn't Need More." I will link to it on my blog at NicoleSandler.com. Cliff, it is great to talk with you. We don't do it often enough. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Let's do it more. Thank you for having me on, Nicole. I really appreciate it.
You got it. Also, don't catch the Unprecedented podcast. That's Cliff's new project. How often do you do those?
We do two a week. We do one for free on Monday or Tuesday, and then we had Malcolm Nance last week, and we had Shan Watts of the week before. Those are our paid ones, so that we can. We're not getting rich off it. I promise you. We do have some bills to pay to run the whole thing. But so that this week we got Jared Yates Sexton coming on, who wrote a book on Trump and covered all those crazy rallies and has been an inspirational force out there. So come by. It's unprecedentedpodcast.com. It's unprecedented because we were making fun of Trump when he tried to say unprecedented, and he said unprecedented, and we all said we'd like to unprecedent you. So that's
yes.
the goal.
I will link to that as well. Cliff Schechter, thank you so much. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye. All right. Coming up in a few minutes, Jeff Bryant, who writes about education, because we got some teacher strikes going on.
I read the news today.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The president on Wednesday signed an order to deploy National Guard troops to the U.S.-Mexican border. Speaking at the White House, Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen framed the move as a way to toughen an immigration system that she said rewards bad behavior.
Tonight for President Trump, a border surge.
It's time to act.
To combat what he calls an unchecked flow of illegal immigrants, the president directing the Pentagon and Department of Homeland Security to work with border state governors to deploy National Guard troops.
We do hope that the deployment begins immediately. We're working with all haste.
Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen announcing some troops could arrive as early as tonight, but offering no details about how many or where they'd go.
We hope to have the path forward very much specified in the near future.
A plan being written in real time, hours after the president vowed he'll take strong action, and following days of Mr. Trump venting frustration, responding to reports of a caravan of migrants that has since been dispersed.
Until we can have a wall and proper security, we're going to be guarding our border with the military. That's a big step.
Past presidents have done the same. Obama dispatched 1,200 National Guard members. George W. Bush, 6,000. Troops that by law are barred from making arrests, expected to work in a support role. The administration tonight also touting initial progress, delivering on the president's signature campaign promise.
We have started building, as you know, so we're building real time in Clexia.
How much new wall have we built at this point?
So to us, it's all new wall. If there is a wall before that needs to be replaced, it's being replaced by a new wall. So this is the Trump border wall.
Peter Alexander, NBC News, the White House.
Scott Pruitt, the embattled EPA administrator, sat for an interview with Fox News' Ed Henry, saying that he wasn't aware that two aides received pay raises after the White House refused to allow it.
A report that Pruitt went to the White House last month and demanded big pay raises for two aides. The White House said, no, this is not a good use of taxpayer money. Pruitt allegedly ignored that White House directive and gave out the pay raises anyway. Pruitt now claiming to me he was in the dark about the whole thing. It got a little combative.
Now, if you're committed to the Trump agenda, why did you go around the president and the White House to give pay raises to two staffers?
I did not. My staff did, and I found out about that yesterday, and I changed it.
So
PPPO process should have been respected. And I issued a statement yesterday walking back those pay raises that should not have been done.
Somebody being fired for that?
That should not have been done.
And who did it?
It may be there would be some accountability.
A career person or a political person?
I don't know.
You don't know? You run the agency. You don't know who did
this? I found out about this yesterday, and I corrected the action. So, and we are in the process of finding out how it took place and correcting it.
So hang on. Both of these staffers who got these large pay raises are friends of yours, I believe, from Oklahoma, right?
They are staffers here in the agency.
Then they're from Oklahoma. They're friends of yours.
Well, they serve a very important person.
And you didn't know that they got these large pay raises?
I did not know that they got the pay raises until yesterday.
Okay, one of them got a pay raise of, let's see, $28,000. The other was $56,000. Do you know what the median income in this country is?
No, what
is it? $57,000 a year.
Okay.
So one of your friends from Oklahoma got a pay raise that's the medium income.
They did not get a pay raise. They did not get a pay raise.
They did.
No, they did not. They did not. I stopped that yesterday.
Pruitt also defended paying $50 a night for a room in D.C. in the condo owned by the wife of an energy lobbyist.
President Trump said he would drain the swamp. Draining the swamp renting an apartment from the wife of a Washington lobbyist?
I don't think that that's even remotely fair to ask that question.
Okay, so why did you then accept $50 a night to rent a condo from the wife of a Washington lobbyist?
Well, let's talk about that. That is something that, again, has been reviewed by ethics officials here. They've said that it's market rate.
You're renting it from the wife of a lobbyist.
Yeah, who has no business before this agency.
Hold on a second. So who has no business? Mr. Hart is at Williams & Jensen, right? Major lobbying firm. ExxonMobil is a client.
Mr. Hart...
ExxonMobil have business before you, sir?
Mr. Hart has no clients that has business before this agency.
ExxonMobil has no
business. He's a member of a law firm. To take his relationship and extend it...
You're not answering the question.
It was like an Airbnb situation. When I was not there, the landlord, they had access to the entirety of the facility. When I was there, I only had access to a room. There were common areas. They used the facility at the same time that I was there.
So you only paid for the nights you rent that you were there.
That's exactly right.
So, but that's kind of a sweetheart deal because...
No,
like,
it's not.
Your house in Oklahoma, you pay a mortgage on that. And when you don't sleep sleep there, you still pay the mortgage, right?
Not when I'm at use. I mean, yes, but this is,
yes,
a, this is a tremendous difference. I wasn't using the facility, Ed, when I wasn't there.
When asked if the president still has confidence in Pruitt, Sarah Huckabee Sanders didn't give a clear answer.
My question to you has to do with the $50 a night payment that the EPA administrator, Scott Pruitt, paid to a lobbyist that did business with the EPA. As you know, Sarah, the president promised to drain the swamp. His behavior, his actions seem very swamp-like. Why is the president okay with this?
The president's not. We're reviewing the situation. When we have had a chance to have a deeper dive on it, we'll let you know the outcomes of that, but we're currently reviewing that here at the White House.
Does the president have confidence in the EPA administrator at this point?
The president thinks that he's done a good job, particularly on the deregulation front, but again, we take this seriously and we're looking into it, and we'll let you know when we finish. I got
the news. And that's a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener funded, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com/donate.
This is a huge, huge issue.
And we're talking about it. The Nicole Sandler Show on Progressive Voices and NicoleSandler.com.
All right, we are back on this Thursday program. Nicole Sandler here. Jeff Bryant is with People's Action. He blogs at ourfuture.org, and he's the director of the Education Opportunity Network at educationopportunitynetwork.org. Jeff Bryant writes about education. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, thanks for having me on the show again, Nicole. Hey,
thanks for being here. It seems like there's a bit of a sea change brewing when it comes to our public education, and that's a good thing. And it started, I guess it's been about a month now, with the walkout in West Virginia. Was this expected? Did you in the education community know that a big strike was coming in West Virginia, or were you taken by surprise?
I think the education community and the whole country was taken by surprise. Keep in mind that these strikes, the one not only in West Virginia, but the one still ongoing in Oklahoma, the one that's brewing in Kentucky, and then also another one seems to be coming from Arizona. These are wildcat strikes. It's illegal to strike in these states. Collective bargaining is banned. No union organizations have created these strikes. They've been coming from the bottom up by teachers organizing primarily on Facebook. So
wow.
This is really quite a phenomenon.
That's pretty amazing. Because these are all right-to-work states, I live in one as well, Florida, where there are teachers' unions, but collective bargaining, such as we have come to know it, is not really in play. Do I have that right?
That's correct. I don't know the exact percentages, but in Oklahoma, for instance, I don't think a majority of teachers there even belong to the union.
Wow.
Yet they're having almost complete and total support from teachers across the board. It's also important to acknowledge that these outpourings are bipartisan. Many of the people who are protesting and walking out are avowed Republicans and even voted for Donald Trump, but they've just had it.
Well, we're hearing these horror stories of people who've got, you know, two and three or more degrees that are still paying off their student loans after being in the classroom for, you know, 20 plus years, and having to go to food banks to get food because they're not making enough money to feed their family. I saw one interview with a man who couldn't afford to put his wife on his health insurance. This is no way to live. I mean, it shows that obviously these states don't value the teachers. I'm wondering do you think the public is getting tired of the austerity measures that are hurting our kids?
I think that's a big part of it, that there is a growing hostility toward the decay and dwindling support that we have in public from public institutions. But it's important to understand why this is happening among teachers. Public schools are probably the most public institutions in the country. They are, without a doubt, the country's greatest collaborative project. I mean, almost everybody is affected by a public school, either by paying taxes into it or sending your kids to it. And because public schools still educate over 90% of the school in the country, public school teachers are the first to see the trauma in children's lives, the lack of health care in their families, the increase in poverty, the problem of parents having to work multiple jobs. Those problems are most visible first in public schools when little kids come to school.
Yeah. In fact, in West Virginia, while the teachers were on strike, there were a number of towns and cities, I guess, where they still went about getting meals for these kids, because in many instances, the meal they got at school might be the only meal they got that day.
Oh, yeah. That's becoming widespread, not only for schools to increase free meals from lunch to also breakfast, but even for schools to provide a free meal of some sort during weekends and holidays.
Wow.
And summer days off. In Oklahoma schools, the schools are so poorly funded. Oklahoma has cut back education funding 28% since 2008. many of the schools, one out of five school districts is so poorly funded that they've cut back to a 4-day week.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one of the things that they're fighting for in Oklahoma. So let's start with West Virginia, though, because this is where this kind of all started. So they were out for about 9 days. Again, as you called it, sort of a wildcat strike, because they didn't have the right to strike, but they did anyway. Did they get what they wanted?
Yes, they did. Not only did they get what they wanted, but they had to even buck the semblance of union leadership they have in the state in order to do it. I think their initial demand was for a 6 or 7% raise. The teachers' union leaders were able to negotiate a 3.5% raise out of the legislature. The West Virginia's teachers said, no dice. We want more. We want at least a 5% deal. We want not only raises for ourselves, we want raises for our support staff in schools. We want raises for public employees, not just in schools, but all public employees. We want to be sure that we can still have union dues deducted from our paychecks. The legislature threatened to end that practice. Mm. We want some kind of restrictions on the growth of charter schools. So there were a number of demands made, and they virtually got all of their demands met. It's interesting how, in a way, conservative lawmakers that have been doing everything they can for years to disarm unions have, in some respects, now become part of a backlash where, strike negotiations were more formal. The leaders of whatever kind of organization was creating the labor unrest met with administrators or whoever was holding the hands of the money, and they negotiated in a very formal way. That, with this new form of uprising that's occurred in these wildcat strikes, that kind of formal managed collective bargaining process is now not there anymore. And so lawmakers are having to deal with these strikes where the demands can sometimes change over time as teachers decide among themselves what it is that they really want.
Well, in Oklahoma, the teachers were just given like a $6,000 raise.
Right.
They said that wasn't enough. And again, saying it wasn't only about the money for them. They need more money than the $6,000. I think they're looking for $10,000 over a 5-year period, if I read that correctly. But
that is correct, yeah.
But they want the support staff. They want textbooks. They want to go back to a 5-day week, right? All these things are included in it. And it sounds like they've got a long way to go.
Yeah, they want $200 million for new textbooks, supplies, and other materials. Most of the teachers are having to deal with textbooks and learning supplies from the 1990s. Teachers have to bring in their own pencils and paper, materials like that. And in the meantime, you know, their pay is continuously inadequate as they've gone 10 years without a raise. And so they're saying, no, we need not only a pay increase, but our kids need supplies. They need good learning materials. They need up-to-date textbooks. And so they're holding out for the $200 million. The latest I've heard of this was yesterday. There's more transpiring today. Was that the legislature said, okay, we'll raise $20 million through a tax on internet retail businesses. But the teachers are asking for more than that. They're pointing out that, for instance, a few years ago, the state got rid of its tax on capital gains. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, we want that repealed so that we can use that money to fund schools. So they're not giving in. And you're right about their demands going beyond the typical labor demands of wage and benefits. They're demanding things for their kids and for their schools and for their communities.
I don't see how anyone could be in Oklahoma right now. I mean, I've seen enough news coverage on it and seen pictures of the textbooks that are falling apart, that have masking tape holding them together. As you said, some of them are from the 90s. It's really a shame. So Oklahoma now, they're in their third or fourth day of being out on strike and with no signs of letting up, are there?
Not that I'm aware of. I've been looking at news reports this morning, and they are in their fourth day. Many of the lawmakers are starting to dig in their heels. The governor of Oklahoma yesterday, Mary Fallon, was at some kind of event where she insulted the teachers by saying that they're acting like a bunch of teenagers who want a better car. She's gotten quite a bit of a backlash from that. I don't think that insulting teachers right now is a very good strategy on her part.
No.
A number of lawmakers have said that they think the teachers are losing ground, but the Oklahoma Educators Association published this poll results yesterday that found that 77% of adults they surveyed in the state back the teachers. That figure is up from 58% last week. So it seems that actually support for the teachers is growing. But to go back to your point about, you know, how could people live in Oklahoma, that's exactly part of the problems that the teachers are trying to address. Many teachers don't want to live in Oklahoma anymore. Mm-hmm. They can't afford to. They can go across the state to Texas and make $5,000 more right off the bat. So, teachers are seeing their colleagues, oftentimes their good friends who are experienced, quality teachers, having to move away for financial reasons. And they are saying that this is a problem. It's not only a problem for me being able to do my job because, you know, I've got to take in their kids to my classroom, but it's also doing harm to children who need experienced, high quality teachers in the classroom.
Jeff Bryant is with us of the Education Opportunity Network, talking about the strikes that are going on. You know, throughout history, there used to be more strikes. I remember I grew up in New York City, and I remember a huge teacher strike when I was in elementary school, you know, in the 60s. I couldn't tell you what year it was. I remember we were out of school for a while. But those used to be in a city or a borough or, you know, not statewide like we're seeing now. This is a new phenomenon, isn't it?
As far as I know, it is fairly new, but there have been statewide teacher strikes. There was one in Oklahoma in 1990, and West Virginia also had one some time ago. I'm not sure exactly the date, but for them to occur this closely together is really unusual. And many people are pointing to how the influence of social media has become key to this, much like in the way that the Parkland, Florida school kids who were victims of the school shootings were able to organize a school walkout day in protest not too long ago that it's estimated over a million and a quarter of people participated. So the dynamics of the strikes are very different from in the past, and people aren't sure where this is going to go. We've talked about Arizona, where teachers have not declared any sort of strike day yet, but they have insisted on a 20% in pay increase. And the governor's digging in his heels, so it seems like the Arizona teachers are going to take a lesson from West Virginia and now Oklahoma. Also now in North Carolina, where I live, teachers are organizing a school protest day on the 14th of May. North Carolina here again is another one of these states where education funding has been cut back atrociously. Schools are being funded less than they were in 2008. Teacher pay has lagged. North Carolina used to be in the middle of the pack, and now we're close to the bottom. So it seems like this is the trend. And who knows where it's going to come next.
Is it the case that a lot of these cuts came in 2008 after the big recession came in? And then when the economy started improving and money started coming back into the coffers, they just never replaced the money that was taken out of education. And that's why we're in such bad shape?
Yes. 29 states today fund schools less than they did in 2008.
Wow.
When you look at also the local revenue sources that go to schools, and by the way, state revenue and local revenue combined make up about 90% of school funding. But when you look at those figures combined, the number of schools, the percentage of schools who are underfunded compared to 2008 is well into the 30s. Schools have been sort of the forgotten child of the recovery. Lawmakers in many, particularly Republican states, have been putting into place the policy direction that the best thing to do to bring back the economy is to pass tax cuts, especially on wealthy people.
Right.
And in most states, education is the biggest share of the budget, along with health care. They usually each vie for what's the biggest user of state revenues. And so what states did when they cut taxes is they, instead of cutting, instead of turning to cut medical systems to cut and Medicare and things like that, which are harder to cut, they cut schools instead. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say it's criminal. It's hurting our kids. It's hurting the future. There just seems to be blinders on here instead of, you know, playing the long game. They're very short-sighted.
Schools have become sort of a easy whipping post in some respects. Only about 1 in 5 households in America has a child with of school aged who's of school age, and people who have school aged children are increasingly poor. Over half the school population now, the student population in schools is low income kids.
Wow.
So that kind of combination has led to some disempowerment of public school families. Their voices are often not heard, and politicians often don't pay very much attention to that population of people. And in the meantime, school teachers are often reluctant to speak out because they can get fired.
Right.
But we're seeing now that in these states where the strikes are taking place, you can't fire all the teachers. It just won't work. As a collective voice, they're becoming very powerful.
And now, as you say, they have the support of the parents and the growing support of the public who see what's going on. Do you think the activism of the kids from Parkland is having any impact on maybe the courage to go out there and do this?
I think absolutely it is. If you look at surveys of teachers on the issue of gun violence, much like the Parkland students are saying, teachers believe that the way to deal with it is not by hardening schools and arming teachers.
Mm-hmm.
Teachers generally do not want guns in schools. They do not want to carry firearms. But when they see the firsthand damage done to their children, and it's not just these mass school shootings that teachers see. I was talking to a group of teachers recently, this was in Chicago, who showed up to open up school, and there was a dead body out in the front of the school. He was a victim of a shooting that night.
Oh, God.
They had to figure out how to deal with the children because the buses were arriving, and these were elementary school kids.
Oh, my.
And they had to figure out how to deal with that. And this kind of gun violence is rife, especially in low-income communities of color, where teachers have to worry about how their students come to and go from school, because they could go along routes that are dangerous because of gun violence. So teachers see the have been seeing the problem of gun violence for a long time, and much like the Parkland students, they've had it. But here again, teachers are in a precarious place in their communities, and it's hard for them sometimes to act. To exercise their free speech in an open manner. But I think, yes, the Parkland students have given them some motivation because they're seeing how their own students are leading.
Right. How bad has Betsy DeVos been for public schools?
Well, I don't think anybody can imagine a worse school leader than Betsy DeVos. She has significantly undermined public education since she came aboard. Her budgets have been crippling to the department, and unfortunately they haven't passed. Congress has actually bucked her and basically ignored her recommendations. But it shows her intent. She's now considering pulling back discipline guidelines that were erected by the federal government because of information coming through their sources that students, especially low-income black and brown students, are being suspended at very high rates compared to white students, and that it's because schools sometimes, maybe unintentionally or not, it doesn't make any difference, have discriminatory policies in their discipline programs. She would like to pull back that those protections. She would like to pull back some protections that students have based on their sexuality, their gender preference. Those are things that, she rescinded the Obama administration's requirements that schools allow students to use bathrooms of their gender preference.
Right.
She's also intent on ramping up lots of money for voucher programs and charter schools. And those are all places where money gets redirected to. We've been talking about how poorly funded our schools are. Instead of pushing for some things that could increase their funding, she's instead pushing for things that would take more of their funding away.
Right.
So it's just poor leadership on her part. And like I said, I can't imagine a worse person to have in charge at this point.
Do you yearn for the days of bitching about Arnie Duncan?
Well, I tell you what, Arnie Duncan was a problem of a different type. He had a lot of popular support that was bipartisan. It's hard to compare the two. Mm-hmm. I did, as you readily know, complain a lot about Arnie Duncan. But I'll say this about Betsy DeVos. She is almost universally despised. She's the most unpopular cabinet member, certainly in Trump's cabinet, mm-hmm. and that's quite a stretch. But probably the most popular cabinet member ever.
Wow.
And that is really unheard of for an education secretary. Most people don't even pay any attention to who the education secretary is.
No. So we're stuck with her. One other point that should be made is, for all her pushing for privatizing public schools and for charter schools, generally teachers in private schools and charter schools make even less than public school teachers.
Yes, that's true. Also, in the charter school sector, teacher attrition is much higher than it is in public schools. By attrition, I mean teachers don't stay that long in their jobs.
Right.
That's because charter schools don't have, we've already mentioned, a collective bargaining power that teachers have in some places. But charter schools don't have, they don't have to comply with labor regulations in general. Because although they are called public schools by the charter school industry, they in fact act like private businesses. And even if they're ever subject to a lawsuit, for instance, by a teacher who thinks she has been unfairly treated, the charter school organization will say, well, we're not a public institution, we're a private institution.
Wow.
So they don't have to comply with a lot of regulatory labor mandates that you know serve as sort of safeguards for employees. So therefore, they can demand teachers, you know, to stay especially long hours without necessarily getting any extra pay.
Sure.
They can hold all kinds of demands of teachers, and so oftentimes teachers just don't want to stay there very long.
Well, it makes sense. Sadly, makes sense. Teachers aren't wanting to stay in their public school jobs either. Jeff Bryant of the Education Opportunity Network, thank you so much. I'm going to post links to some of the articles you've written up on my blog at NicoleSandler.com along with today's show so people can go and read it. We'll keep all eyes on Oklahoma and Kentucky and Arizona and North Carolina and out for our kids. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Nicole. Always a pleasure.